Lori.
Hi.
So I am super stoked to talk to you today, mainly about the tech interview pipeline and the maybe issues that we see with that. But I wanted to kick it off, and I know that you are a board game aficionado. I am as well. And I was wondering, what do you have on deck? What are you playing right now? What are the board games that we should check out?
So I have a new obsession with the game Azul. I don't know if you've seen
it's great.
Right? It's so much fun. It's aesthetically pleasing, which I always love. But I love making friends play for the first time on the side of the board that isn't predetermined and watching them get through two rounds and think they're doing really well and then panic that they didn't plan out their pattern well, and they're like locked and they can't do anything.
I like that one. And a lot of my focus in general lately, because I have all these really complicated board games that, you know, take 2 hours to explain and set up. And what I really love, like I've been trying to, and Azul fits in this, it's the A plus games, right? That are really deep and have a lot of strategy, but don't take an hour to, or, you know, are intimidating to get started with.
Exactly. I always love games like that, like Splendor, for example. My husband and I learned it as a two-player game, and it was fun the first time we played it, but we're like, oh, that's all there is to it. And the second time we played it, we realized that it gets more and more kind of like analytical and subversive.
Nice.
And I love that because, you know, at first glance, it's super simple and easy. And then you realize that you can start purposefully preventing the other player from doing well. And it gets really tactical.
That's nice. I've also really loved Moniker lately. I don't know if you seen this one.
Ooh, no, I haven't seen that one.
So it's like, so there's Cards Against Humanity, right? Which I played and it was all chuckles and you get to see grandma say just absolutely naughty things. And then, but like after a few times, it's like, wow, grandma saying naughty things and I don't like it. It's like Facebook during political season and I don't want it anymore.
Right.
So Moniker kind of takes that place. It's like this party game and you can play with up to 40 people. And it's actually kind of a Creative Commons license. It doesn't have like a copyright or whatever. You could make your own version of this game. But it starts and, you know, you go around and it's kind of this combination of charades and guess the entity and just really is one of my favorite fun party games.
Like yeah, I was just gifted. I don't know if you've played Codenames, but yeah. I was gifted the Harry Potter version of Codenames, which I haven't tried yet. So that's definitely on deck.
Yeah, Moniker's in the same like category as Codenames in terms of, you know, like a fun party game that gets people enthusiastic. It's super simple though. And that's what I love too. Like I just love something you can hop into and everybody kind of inherently understands and you can just have fun.
But I'm going to have to check this out.
I'll also play a 12-hour Twilight Imperium session.
Oh, do you have Twilight Struggle?
Yes. I have it and haven't played it. I've been scared of it, to be honest.
It's a little intimidating. I'm not going to lie. We've gotten through it, I think, two or three times. And every time I have to refresh the rules for like 5 hours.
Yeah, it's thick. Is it GMT Games that makes it? And they make all the like the simulation games. Like you get their train simulators where you have like a functioning stock market. And, you know, it's like, wow. That's really...
We get smarter when we play these things. Learn a little bit of history.
So they have a mini game that's called Twilight Squabble. It's hilarious and it's a tiny box, like it's like a 4x3 box, and you know it takes 20 minutes to play it, and it's like the essence of Twilight Struggle but in this tiny little box. And if you like Twilight Struggle, you might like it.
I'm definitely gonna have to look all of these things up. My husband's gonna thank you so much for all the money I'm about to spend.
Yeah it's I have to stop watching board game YouTube sometimes.
BoardGameGeek.com is dangerous for me. I subscribe to their newsletter and I just should not. Because
it's like, yep, need that.
We'll yeah, it exactly. Sometime. It's like, oh, there's a Kickstarter. I mean, it's not like I can wait. If I don't give them money, then the game won't exist and I won't get to play it.
Bonuses, miniatures stuff. Yeah, great. So this is a podcast about software development. So
board games
are awesome. And I think there's a lot of crossover there, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
But I was curious, how did you become a software developer? What was your path to this field of work?
So it's a little bit weird. So I, starting from a really, really young age, I was going to be an attorney because both of my parents are lawyers. And my dad tried really hard to convince me not to do that.
Yeah.
And going into college, I was like, okay, I'm going to study government, so I'll do great in law school, but I'm going to also major in mathematics because I just loved math. I always loved math.
Mm-hmm.
And the kind of merging of those two things is political polling because I particularly like statistics. And I happened to go to a college, Franklin and Marshall College in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where they have a political poll that runs off of campus. And I interned there for 3 years and I had a boss, shout out to Angela, who was amazing. And she said, the only way I'm going to let you be a summer intern instead of just a school year intern is if you promise me that you'll take a computer science 101 course while you're interning, like in the evenings. And I kind of pushed back and I was like, I'm not that geeky. I'm not that hardcore. And she's like, no, no, I've had to teach myself all this stuff. If you ever want to work in this field, it's going to serve you really well. And this is the advice I wish I'd gotten. And so, of course, she was right. And I loved it. And I ended up minoring in it and eventually getting my master's. And the rest is kind of history.
Yeah. And then here we are, right?
Like right. Exactly. Yeah, no time has passed since she gave me that advice and today at all.
Now you're a consultant, essentially, right? Like you work for a consultancy and you, right. you help organizations build software and that sort of thing. And like looking at you know, your past and the present and your observations about this field, what are some qualities of a really good software consultant?
I think there's a lot of things. Software consultants have to be comfortable wearing a lot of hats and being unopinionated, which sounds weird because obviously you're supposed to give your perspective and your ideas, but you can't sit there and say, this is the technology I like and this is the technology I'm going to use. You have to ask the right questions and make sure that you're picking tools and solutions that work for the constraints and the realities of your clients. And that's kind of the opposite of how a lot of like product builders work in terms of, hey, like I love working with React or I love working with Python and I'm going to go out and look for a job where I can do that. I don't have that luxury and that's both a blessing and a curse. Mm-hmm. I learn whatever it is that I need to learn to best solve the problems of the clients that I work with.
Does that keep you in, I don't know, almost like a mild state of panic, I would think in terms of like new clients or new projects, do you go in and you know, how do you deal with that? Like this feeling that I don't really, 100% know this, but I can learn it, right?
Yeah. I was talking to my boss about this probably about a year ago. And I said, I'm doing too much constant learning where I feel like I'm constantly in free fall and I'm constantly like on unfamiliar terrain and I don't really know which direction to go. And one of the things he mentioned, and I think has really served true, is if you're going to be in a field where you're constantly learning, which all of software development is to a certain extent,
right.
you need to make sure that you have a pretty good balance between learning and then using what you've learned. If you don't get to use it for any length of time beyond solving like a quick immediate problem, you just get frustrated because you're constantly going through these iterations of feeling stupid, right?
Yeah.
It's okay to feel dumb maybe 50% of the time, but feeling dumb 100% of the time gets frustrating and a little bit panic inducing. So you're absolutely right. It is hard. And I've tried to find a balance, and 10 Mile, my company, has been really great in helping me find that balance. And then the other thing is you get really good at failing quickly with documentation. I've learned a lot about what good docs look like, at least for my type of learning. And so when I need to solve a problem, when I need to learn a new technology, I'm pretty fast at doing a quick scan, figuring out if investing time in this particular resource is helpful. And if it isn't, I go on to the next one because I don't have the time to waste and it's not going to help me solve the problem.
So what are you looking for in good docs? What are the signals that speak to you when you are doing this research?
So it does a bit depend on what I'm working on. So if it's a technology that I already know, I tend to look for a straight up like API write-up saying, these are the parameters and these are the functions available to you. And here's an example or two of how they work. I'm big on examples. If it's something I don't know at all, I much prefer kind of a scaffolding or a skeleton of what a project should look like or a function should look like or an example. And then I'll take that, deal with all the DevOps environment setup nonsense on my computer, but I know that the code itself is working. And if I can get it running, then I know I can iterate that code to the point I need it to be in. So I'm not struggling on two fronts at once, as it were.
So you mentioned like setup and DevOps nonsense. And I agree with, like, I think, you know, people are like, oh, it's so confusing. I had a hard time learning React. And then, you know, they write a whole article about it. And really what they've written about is their struggles with like Webpack and Flow and
right.
you know, learning Redux and like all the stuff that goes around a project. you know, like the initial setup is where a lot of the struggle is. And then once it's set up, you know, many people can attack the problem, I think, easier. What do you do to deal with that initial setup nonsense? Like, how do you approach that?
Yeah, so it's actually funny. Ashley McNamara had a tweet a while back where she was talking about how so many tutorials that we see are kind of missing this step zero of, you know, the things you don't know if you're not familiar with that piece of technology. I think for front end, the rise of CLIs has been really helpful. For other pieces of code, I'll look for GitHub repositories for sure. Anytime I can find a CodePen or a JS Fiddle or something similar, that's really wonderful because it's removing all of that other nonsense. Mm-hmm. And when you remove all that noise, I'm like, oh, if this is working here, I'm just missing XYZ. But I think a lot of it comes with experience and saying, okay, I've seen that error. I know that's an NPM error, or I know that's a versioning issue or a permissions issue. And I wish there was, you know, a better answer for that other than once you see it a couple times, it kind of sticks in your brain and you remember it for next time.
Like for me too, it's a lot, you know, like how do you read logs and how do you, you know, parse that, right? Like it's so much noise and then you're trying to find the actual problem. And like for me, from years of teaching in like a workshop setting and actually being, you know, like a consultant too, like the ability to spot simple typos or little, you know, just little patterns, right? Like a visual scan that gives you pattern recognition, I guess is the word.
It's funny that you say that because I'm pretty sure anyone who follows me on Twitter will see that every Friday I'm posting some really stupid typo that's my signal that I need to go home.
Yeah, it's time for the weekend.
Right.
On one hand, it's disheartening, right? You spend hours and you discover that it was like a misplaced character. And at the same time, there's this sense of exhilaration that comes from like solving that problem. So like to me, you mentioned it, kind of the trough of despair of just, you know, kind of this feeling of ignorance that we get in software. And then so you go and I feel really dumb. And then you feel like, you know, a super genius and then really dumb and then a super genius. And it's a sine wave of
it's funny. It's kind of like the definition of being a software developer, right? It's constant despair, and then you get like 5 seconds of elation, and then you're back in despair for the next problem.
Yeah, I love it. And, you know, it's like you get the flow state, and the puzzling aspect of the whole operation is really fun, if that's your definition of fun, I suppose.
Right. So I always tell people I was a bit, this is a bad, you know, thing to be, but I was kind of Hermione Granger in school. Mm-hmm. That was kind of my personality type in schoolwork and classes and stuff. And I think that's why I make a good software developer, because I cared about grades and I cared about those like wins that told me I was doing a good job. And I've just taken that mentality and moved it to Jira tickets. And so we're good.
Yeah. I know this is important in your work and you've talked about this before. And I'm really curious, at some point in your career, you are probably going to end up being a teacher and a mentor. And I'm wondering why that's important. Why is it important to have, you know, more teachers and more mentors helping folks?
Obviously, we know we have a shortage of people in this industry in general. And, you know, kind of as we progress, every field and every area is going to require some kind of technical literacy and knowledge. And we're constantly looking for, you know, mid-level people and senior-level people, and those don't just appear. We grow them. Right. And so as much as everyone in the industry can kind of use the struggles they've been through and their learning and their experience, you know, wanting to throw a computer out the window because of some stupid bug, and make that available for other people to leverage and kind of like climb on top of their shoulders, I think we've made it so that we can focus more on what matters and the more gray area conversations that we have around what we're building and why we're building it and how it's having an impact, instead of, okay, I just spent, you know, 5 hours getting Webpack to build. I don't have any energy to have these harder, kind of more important conversations.
Yeah. What you're describing to me sounds a lot, and I'm a front end person, like that's like my general job description. And, you know, we talk about UX a lot and understanding our users and the problems we're trying to solve. Is that kind of a part of that? Are we, as a group of folks with more experience, imparting that kind of knowledge and passing that along? Is that part of being a good mentor?
Yeah, I think it's everything. I think it's teaching people, especially people new to the industry, that asking the right questions isn't just about asking Google the right questions. It's about asking the right questions in general at kind of a meta level and within the problem domain that you're working. It's continuing to refocus ourselves again on the stuff that matters. And yeah, sometimes that means the performance of splice versus the spread operator. But if we have that written up somewhere and someone's kind of made that knowledge available and not something that you need to test for yourself, then that's half the time that you could have spent on that issue and you can focus on something that maybe has a bit more impact.
So when do you know that it's a good time to actually ask for help, right? Like, we do a lot of research. We spend a lot of our time, you know, Googling and reading Stack Overflow and banging our head against a problem. And, you know, at some point it becomes more efficient just to, you know, either fire up Zoom or message somebody or walk over to their desk if that's your situation and ask for help. And how do you know when that's the time?
I will admit to being a terrible use case for this. The first software engineering job that I had a wonderful technical lead who let me ask a truly staggering number of questions. I mean, the stupidest stuff, and I hate to use the word stupid, but things that I easily could have Googled, and instead I went and asked him, and he would answer them. And the rule that kind of worked for us was I never asked the same question twice. Yeah. And so he was always willing to answer. But I think one of the things we take for granted is that when you enter this field, you don't have that Google foo, as it were. You don't necessarily know the keywords you should be putting in.
Yeah, the vocabulary.
Or how to find the right answers. And so I think if you try one or two searches, or if you really feel like you don't even know where to start, feel free to reach out to someone to ask a question. I don't think there's anything wrong with asking questions. I think the problem comes when you don't take that data point and kind of store it away for later. That's why I talk about developer journals a lot. Basically, the idea that you have a document somewhere, whether it's online or directly static on your laptop, that keeps track of all the resources you've looked at and all the problems you've solved so that you aren't having to solve the same thing twice.
I encourage people to start blogs if they're able to and have the time and inclination. And to me, like in my career, when I first started, I was 35 years old. I couldn't just jump into this job and, you know, make a very entry-level salary because I had bills to pay. So I used my space on the internet, it's still joelhooks.com, as basically my developer journal. I'd solve a problem, like get a problem, be confused, do the research, ask somebody, and then take that information and basically write a journal entry to myself about, you know, what the problem was and how I solved it. And, you know, that's the situation where you end up Googling and in the future you land on your own,
exactly.
Solution, which is like an amazing feeling. It's like, wow, look at me doing my past self, doing my future self a solid. Like that's amazing. Is that similar? Is that kind of the similar approach to what a developer journal would be?
It absolutely is. And I think that's why a lot of people actually recommend that people who are beginning write blogs. And I think that's a great recommendation. Mm-hmm. But I also think not everyone is comfortable with that. Not everyone wants to kind of put themselves out there in a public way. And so there's a lot of different ways to get that same benefit. It can be taking notes for yourself. It can be taking notes for a small group of people, maybe if you have some kind of study group that you're sharing things with, or it can be, you know, publishing it for the world to see. And then you'll end up like I did this morning where someone said, "Hey, Lori, your example's broken. Go fix it."
Yeah. Now you get to support your blog post.
Right.
I recommend turning comments off. I don't have comments on my blog because I have never had a fruitful conversation in that way. And a lot of this really gets down to, and I think, you know, another aspect of this is technical writing, which I think is a hugely important skill to have as a software developer on a team, especially as we get more into remote work and this sort of thing. We have to write, and this communication is important. What are your thoughts on learning and becoming a good technical writer?
When people ask me kind of what my most critical skill that I think has kind of made the difference in my career is, it's always writing. I went to a liberal arts school and I majored in government, so I had to do a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
I think technical writing, there's a couple things that kind of come to mind. There are different voices that you can use and there are different audiences that those apply to. So for a while, a lot of the technical writing that existed was kind of this white paper style, a lot of keywords, very formal, almost read like a lab report for the hard sciences. And I think we've moved away from that, made kind of more conversational style technical writing that helps people who need something a bit more accessible and explaining things in layman's terms, using examples that aren't all kind of like geek chic, as it were. I love Ali Spittle, obviously does some really funny stuff with music lyrics from like the 90s and modern, which I love. Yeah. And so I think having things that are accessible and people can relate to or kind of pique their interest is important. And I think it's also important to think about kind of how much you are including in what you're writing. Things that are bite-sized are a lot more accessible. And so I try as best as I can to break things down into kind of the lowest common denominator that I can. And so I was recently diving into ES 2019, for example, and every single feature that I came across that I wanted to write about was its own post. And I'd give probably, you know, 2 to 3 examples of it and more explanations behind it. But the idea is that someone can kind of jump in on their lunch break and see something that's short and not super intimidating and a quick thing for them to learn and look at.
Like on Egghead, if you go and you look at the videos, and we have courses and all that fun stuff because people love things that are packaged and they can watch, but you can also like take any individual lesson out of that. And we really strive to cover like a single concept. Like I want you to, you know, get this, take it away, spend 5 minutes watching this instead of, you know, something buried in the middle of an hour and a half, which would be the difference between long form articles too. To me, written words are much more accessible than video in that regard.
Yeah, I was joking with someone on Twitter the other day about going to YouTube to find a solution to a problem and being like, just get to the point already. I actually, the ES 2019 stuff, at least a couple of those are currently Egghead videos of mine.
Oh, nice. Let's get into what's wrong with the way that software developers are interviewed and hired in this kind of modern age of web development.
Let the ranting begin.
That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, so I'm really passionate about this topic. I don't really know when I became passionate about this topic, but I think a lot of it has to do with feeling like I've passed the gates of jobs where I kind of got lucky and then really exceeded expectations when I was in the role, and looking back and feeling like there was a really significant disconnect between the skills that I had that my managers were really excited about and thought brought value to the team, and the skills that I had been tested on in the interviews. And I think this is pretty common, especially with the kind of stereotypical major company whiteboard interviews, crack the coding interview, all of that stuff.
Yeah. So I have that book. It's super thick. And I was reading it and I got it because I was curious. And like, here's full disclosure. I've had a very like light experience in terms of interviewing. Both times I've had, and I've only had two in my life, had a technical interview. They simply wanted to talk about articles on my blog. And I look at this, you know, that's great for me. But when you're looking at this technical interview, I would never pass. I don't even know like how to approach that. And like, I'm 10 years into this career and I would never pass without, you know, just simply like cramming and prepping for a specific job interview. And I don't even know, like at the end of the day, like, you know, does that really signify how this person will perform, or can they do this job that we have at hand? And what can we do to be better? Like, how do we improve that? And is that even a necessary part of the standard for hiring folks?
I saw someone write the other day that even if you study and you, you know, do cover to cover cracking the coding interview, there's still a fair amount of luck involved in kind of what whiteboarding question they put in front of you and how to the forefront of your mind it is, and whether it's something that you really, really studied, and okay, the solution is optimized for a hash table, which you know really well, versus a linked list, which you're a little more uncomfortable with, all that kind of nonsense. We like to think it's objective, and it's not. In my experiences, I don't think people need to code in interviews, which is kind of like this crazy, outlandish statement. There's a couple reasons for this, but the one that sticks out to me is the idea that coding in an interview is allowing you to ask the best questions and get the best people and kind of see whether or not they can code when you put them in your company. The two experiences aren't similar. Coding in front of people with a specific amount of time in a blank IDE, or not an IDE, as it were, and kind of going through this whole process is not at all related to jumping into an existing code base, pattern matching, figuring out problems, fixing bugs, making new features. There's this big difference between kind of like a blinking cursor and what most of us experience, which is integrating or working with existing things. And there's not a great way to test for that unless you make like a mini little bug for people to solve, which, you know, if you want to do that, okay. What I like to do and what we at 10 Mile have done a fair amount of is we look at a resume and find something that piques our interest and ask them about it and say, what did you build? What did you like about it? What was your experience? And we're not looking for what they don't know. We're looking for them to show us what they do know. And instead of these kind of repetitive questions that we think size up everyone exactly the same way, which they don't, we are catering to the experiences that our applicants have had and seeing how they might be able to teach us something new.
It's funny when you say that, because now I look back to these job interviews that I've had that I described, and I'm like, those were good job interviews. Like, that's what we did. Like, I didn't have, could give me a blinking cursor or a whiteboard, and what you're going to receive in return is crippling performance anxiety for me, right? Like, I just don't, that's not who I am. And that's not what this job is. You know, for most circumstances, it's not a live performance gig. I don't know. I have a really like hard time with that sort of scenario. And one of my ideas is that, you know, what if we you know, paid people, right? Like, what if we paid people for their time and did kind of like gave them assignments and that sort of thing? And I don't know how that scales, but to me, that seems like a better approach.
Yeah. Some people are doing that. I think it almost can't be a one size fits all, which I know is a struggle for people because they're thinking hiring, it has to be the same, it has to be objective. But if we kind of threw that away and said, okay, it's never going to be objective because it's people interviewing other people and we have no idea how their day is going thus far and kind of, you know, what their mindset is. They may be in a position to do their best. They may not. If we kind of throw that away, I think we get to a point where we say, how best can the candidate show us their skills and their knowledge and what they know and kind of branch off from there. If that's I would like to do a take-home assignment where you pay me and I show you how I code, great. If the answer is I am a great communicator and I want to sit there and I want to explain to you what I've worked on in the past, awesome. If the answer is I would rather just sit there and have you watch me solve a problem or a bug, awesome.
Yeah, like a pair programming kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I think all of those can be viable. And the problem that we run into is this idea that like one size fits all.
Yeah.
And we've done a lot of this because we're so afraid of this false positive where we get someone into our company and they're a total washout, right? And they're like, well, if they hack my coding interview, I'm going to add 7 gates to this interview process to make sure we get the best person. And that doesn't do that at all. It creates a whole bunch of other things that you're screening for that you don't actually care about. And it makes your candidates miserable and it makes them hate you.
Yeah, you end up with a checklist and a linear flow where we're really, I mean, it's more like a graph versus, you know, like a linear boxes that we tick and we go through these boxes and we'll get a good candidate. And that's because of our individuality as humans, it just doesn't work. Right. Like, and you know, it's like I talked about pair programming. And I often see that as, you know, well, you should pair program with your candidates. And unless, you know, that's what the job is, because there are shops where pair programming is integrated, unless that's what the job is, or even some candidates, when they first meet you and you know each other for 5 minutes, they don't want to sit down shoulder to shoulder and they might freeze. So that doesn't work for everybody. So it's like finding what does work. It's a challenge. It's a really hard problem, actually.
It's a really hard problem. And I appreciate that people are starting to talk about it and starting to share ideas and solutions. And I think when people do that, kind of we have a lot of knee-jerk reactions of like, no, that won't work because of X edge case. And what we have to acknowledge is that all of these are going to have edge cases. And so we need the adaptability really ends up being the most important thing. Do what will best allow the candidate to shine and show off what they know. And I know in larger companies that kind of like freaks everybody out. They're like, it has to be the same. And I don't know how to fix that problem, the HR problem and the legal problem and all of that. But I'm hoping we'll get there because we need to.
So I think there's, you know, like risks and rewards for hiring less experienced people. You mentioned that, you know, folks are always looking for mid to very experienced developers. They want, you know, what we call senior developers on staff. Mm-hmm. But then there's the opposite side of this, where what if we, you know, take folks that don't have the same experience and develop them and, you know, develop their skills and their talents and their, you know, professional capacity over time. And I was wondering, have you seen that successfully? And what do you think about that idea?
I've been that kind of newbie engineer who was brought into a company and had the opportunity to learn and really thrive. And I'm so grateful for that experience. There are pros and cons, and really all of the negatives are when you haven't set up your company to provide those mentors and those teachers. That isn't the same thing as saying we have senior engineers on staff. I think it's kind of a two-ply problem, as it were, but we've turned a lot of people into senior engineers based on their expert use of a tool instead of their ability to kind of elevate the people around them, which I don't really have a strong opinion about the titling there, but there is a difference between someone who has that senior engineer experience and someone who is a senior engineer because they are a mentor and because they are a teacher. And if you bring on kind of newer coders who have this amazing drive and ambition and ability to grow so, so fast without resources for them to turn to, then you're doing them a disservice. Even beyond that, I think you want to make sure that you have work for them to do that is at an appropriate level with the support that they need, with the resources that they need, and make sure that you're giving the person who's going to be that resource enough time away from their other tasking, because it's not just a wash. Like, that takes time, that takes energy, and you will see the rewards of that, I have no doubt, but you have to kind of set up your structure in such a way that allows for it.
I've seen one of my favorite ways that I've seen this structured is kind of the apprenticeship model, where you come in and there's folks that are apprentices and then folks that are set up as the mentors. And that, you know, it's just like in your kind of job description that people are going to come in and you're going to help them and you're a lot of the time. And I've seen, you know, people grow and thrive under that environment.
Yeah, I really like it. I think the problem that we see is too often, and I mean, welcome to capitalism, the idea that you're hiring someone who would be a junior, which is not a term I love. And you say in your job description, hey, we just want someone who's excited, someone who's willing to learn, someone who has some foundation. And you end up going with the person who has the most experience and will allow you to pay them the least. And so that's how this kind of rat race starts of, I need to know every framework under the sun, and I need to have done all of these personal projects in order to even get my foot in the door, because there's someone else who will. And I wish I had a solution to that, because I think it kind of benefits those who have the free time and privilege and opportunity to spend all of that energy leveling up. And then we get a bunch of people who look the same and act the same and think the same.
I think, you know, you mentioned, you know, I want to get the person with the most experience at the least price. And I think a lot of folks are timid about like this idea of developing less experienced folks, because they're worried, you know, we're just going to train them and then they're going to leave. They're going to find another job. And so we wasted all this time and effort. And it's like, there's an opposition there, right? Like, if you're trying to save money and you're trying to hire, you know, the least expensive viable solution versus, you know, like guiding somebody through and then elevating their pay along the way and developing a culture in your company that facilitates that and facilitates growth both in skills and, you know, compensation. Like, that's the balance that has to be, you know, if you want to keep them, if you want to, like, that's the organization you're trying to run, and people are going to leave, but how do we do that? How do we keep them in our company and in our organization over time?
It's so true. There is that fear. It's a valid fear in some cases. Yeah, some people are going to leave. It's not going to be the right fit for them after a couple of years. They're a different person than they were when they started. And I think kind of good managers and good companies recognize that experience and being okay with that and kind of championing that comes back around and ends up being beneficial in the long run. But the other thing I'd say is, there's a lot of loyalty that comes from taking a chance on someone. And if you treat them well throughout, as you said, and kind of give them the raises and give them additional opportunities, there's not going to be much reason for them to want to, you know, run somewhere else. I've been saying this a lot lately, but there's two reasons that people leave jobs. One of them is because they're leaving a job. They're being pushed out of an environment because they're not happy there. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is they're not really leaving a job. They're jumping to a new one. There's a pull and an attractiveness of another opportunity that is just different or better in some ways. And if you've kept a good relationship with that person, maybe someday they'll come back. They're certainly going to recommend that as a great place for their friends to go.
That's huge.
This idea that when you leave a job, it's because the job has done something wrong is so backwards and antiquated, especially in our industry where people kind of move around a lot. Mm-hmm. Some of that's money-based. I know that, you know, we're not great about giving raises a lot of the times in certain environments, but it's also because there's so many cool things to try. But your reputation as an employer matters. People talk a lot, and treating people well, especially as their kind of start to their career, I mean, that's immeasurable brownie points.
They can potentially be a champion forever. And if they see somebody that's bright and talented and would fit well in your organization, they'll be like, oh, you should go work here because they're awesome, versus, you know, which can happen. And that's the real risk, you know, over time. It's like, oh, you don't want to work there. That's not a good place.
Right. The first impression being the hiring is something everyone forgets. And the last impression being, you know, kind of that exit interview and how you reacted when they gave their notice is something people also always forget. Those are the two kind of impactful moments that stay in people's minds over time.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, Lori, it was really great chatting with you this afternoon. I appreciate you taking the time out, and I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah, thanks so much. This was fun.
Cheers.